Welcome to the Kofkin Bond podcast. Today we talk about memory, learning and storytelling with our guest Tansel Ali. Tansel is one of the world's leading memory experts and memory coaches. He is an international best-selling author, a four-time Australian memory champion and the man who memorized two yellow page phone books in 24 days. He shares with us the journey of discovering memory techniques, his amazing feats of memory and his tips and tricks for improving your memory and learning performance. He also talks about his work with schools, organisations and individuals and how we can use storytelling to make memory more engaging and effective. Enjoy listening to Tansel Ali, the Memory Master.
Tansel, welcome to our podcast. Now, the listeners would have just heard Jordan's beautiful voice with your introduction there. And now they actually have to listen to me interviewing one of, well, Australia's most renowned memory expert. We have become friends over the last bit of time as well through our mutual introduction of a great friend of both of ours, Maria Dinopoulos. I would like to thank you, but I just want to reiterate some of the things that Jordan has read out in that pre-recording. But Tansel Ali is one of the world's leading memory experts and memory coaches. You're an international best-selling author of the books The Yellow Elephant, Improve Your Memory, and Learn More, Faster, Better, and How to Learn Almost Anything in 48 Hours. You do help thousands of people around the world improve their learning performance or their memory and their learning performance. You're a four-time Australian memory sports champion. Tansel has represented Australia internationally in memory championships in London, Malaysia and Japan, and has shattered numerous memory records. The most remarkable feat, however, came when Tansel memorized two yellow pages phone books in only 24 days for a viral PR campaign that was over 20,000 digits of numbers fully memorized. And as I said to you off air, Tansel, I can remember my telephone number growing up, and I can remember a couple of good friends' telephone numbers that we would actually have to pick up the phone and dial, which is probably why we remembered. It wasn't just in, you know, a computer that we carried in our pocket. But how in the hell do you remember 20,000, you know, in the space of 24 days? But I want to go back, if that's okay, if you could touch on, because you've stated that you didn't always have a great memory. It was something that you had to teach yourself. So can we start with your background? Tell us a little bit about your childhood growing up here in Australia.
Yeah. Firstly, thanks for having me on, Shane. Sorry, Tony. I'm only joking, by the way.
I know.
Yeah. It's always a nice little joke that I crack in there. Look, as a child, I actually had a really good memory. In fact, they used to call me the little memory kid, believe it or not. I used to go to religious school, and I used to teach memorization of the Quran, right, to other kids my age and students. But that was just rote learning, repetition. As I got older, teenage years hit, I forgot all of that. And memory was, you know, pretty average. In fact, it wasn't that great. And as I got older and older, when I say older, in my late teens, early 20s, my memory is really bad. I used to forget conversations. You know, I used to forget what people used to say. And then I used to ask, well, what was that again? I used to, you know, repeat, ask for people to repeat. So it wasn't that great growing up. And, I sort of resigned. I gave up and thinking, yep, this is my memory. This must be normal, you know? So I always sort of gave up, and that was pretty much it. As a young fellow. And then a friend of mine came up to me and said, Tansel, I can remember 40 random objects back to front, you know, any order. And I thought, surely, you know, just, I mean, we went to uni together, and I didn't think of him as anything special, I guess. We were two guys playing guitar in metal bands, like, who the hell are we, type of thing. So I tested him, and he memorized everything. I'm like, you're joking, because I didn't see him write down anything, and, you know, it wasn't doing any weird eye movements, or, you know, he literally memorized everything. I said, how did you do it? He said, oh, it's just memory techniques. I'm like, well, how do you learn this stuff? He goes, oh, I got it from a book. I'm like, well, what's the book's name? You know, and he said, oh, I can't remember. I'm like, you idiot. So anyway, I found out he told me the author was Tony Buzan.
Oh, sorry, keep going. Sorry.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, that's all right. He told me the author was Tony Buzan. So I went and picked up his books and literally just read on memory techniques and was shocked that this wasn't taught in schools. So that's where it all started.
Can I ask a question on that? Because I do know you do play the guitar, and as you said, you played in metal bands. So I'm just picturing you with hair down the middle of your back there and wearing goth makeup as you're standing up on stage. But the when you play guitar or any musical instruments, so I love music or all genres of music. I've been, you know, I go, say, for example, this week we're going to see the MSO play the Terminator movie, as an example, with the actual movie. But when you've got people in an orchestra who have played Bach or Mozart or, you know, the opera of Puccini and things like that, why do they have the sheet music in front of them when they've played it thousands of times? Because when you're up on stage playing your guitar and band, you have muscle memory. You don't actually have the sheet music there and things like that. You actually have muscle memory. So why is it in regards to some people will have muscle memory of, say, playing the guitar on stage but can't remember what they did yesterday?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I mean, things like that are guides as well. No matter how professional you are, having a guide is very, very helpful. So it's just something like that. It's like even when we read, for example, if you're just reading without any guide, your eyes are actually going all over the place. So having, you know, like a finger or a pen or something like that actually guides your eyes, because your eyes don't do the reading, your brain does. So essentially having something there as a guide helps us comprehend that thing a lot better. Now, there's obviously, you know, going up on stage without any guides and playing from, you know, inspiration or from what you can essentially come up with. You can do that as well. There's various forms, people learning different ways. People are used to, you know, different things. So, you know, just having, you know, aids, and, you know, some people don't have aids. It's just, I think it's more of a choice, and we go about it because, you know, that's what we want to be able to do as well. Yeah.
Chancel, you spoke about your friend who introduced you to a book and could memorize 40 random objects. But how did the then journey or the inspiration for you, because this is now your life, how did that journey start for you?
Yeah, well, as soon as my friend told me about these memory techniques, I mean, I was terrible at reading books, but I had to pick up this memory book and I started reading it and I just could not understand anything from it. And I'm like, what's going on? This is not right. So I went to my friend. I said, did you give me the right author? He goes, no, the author's right. Well, what's the book's name? The title was wrong. So went and got the correct book and started reading the memory techniques. I'm like, wow, this is so cool. I can just remember, you know, the planets in order, or, you know, random digits and even people's names and faces all in the space of 10, 15 minutes. I'm like, this is insane. You know, so after I finished that book, I realized I can do all these things. And it wasn't that I had an innate amazing memory. Like I said, I had a pretty shocking memory in my late to early 20s. It was more about unleashing the potential of these techniques. So I thought, this is exciting stuff. I wonder what else I can do. And there was this website. It still exists today. So you can get your people to write this down if you want, or take notes. It's www.google, so google.com. So if you go to this website, you can type in and do a search on memory techniques. And what happens is, websites come up that show you these techniques. So that's what I did, and I was blown away. It's like, hang on, all this is on the internet. None of this was taught in school. So I started reading, learning, researching, getting a bit better. And then I came across the Australian Memory Championships. And I said to my friend, look, let's enter it. We'll come last. Who cares? It'll be a laugh, you know, amongst all these nerds. So anyway, we entered this competition. Didn't really see any nerds. It was just people like you and me interested in their own development. But okay, and this was at, the first event was at Docklands in the, you know, the Marvel Stadium. It wasn't called Marvel back then, Docklands Stadium, back in 2002. And Tony Buzan had flown down from London, you know, big name for mind mapping and memory techniques and so on. And, you know, we're having a kick of the footy, you know, around the offices and stuff. So it was fairly casual. People came from all around Australia and we competed. And, you know, thinking I'd come last with my friend, we actually ended up coming second and third in Australia and breaking all these memory records, you know. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, because we did that, then media got a hold and all of a sudden, well, you know, memory gurus, even though I was like, what the hell just happened?
Tansel, you know, the brain intrigues me, and what we can do and what we can't do. And there's that saying that you know, you don't know what you don't know. But at the same time, I've also looked at that is you actually don't always know what you do know. So every night I play an online Trivial Pursuit game, and there's a whole lot of questions and even things like music, etc. And it's, you know, I sometimes get asked, how do you know the answer to that? And I said, I don't know. It's just in my brain. So in other words, I've read it somewhere. It's been retained. Growing up, I struggled reading. So I was diagnosed as an adult of having a mild form of dyslexia, so not a crippling form of dyslexia. But one of the things one of my teachers did without knowing what dyslexia necessarily was when I was in primary school is she taught me to read in pictures. So now even as a storyteller, everything is in pictures. It's like everything is like movies going on in my head. Yet when I study for an exam, I might do really well in the exam. I'll study. I've not necessarily known somebody who studies that hard, but I'll study for an exam. I'll do the exam. I'll get my score. I pass the exam usually quite well. And then basically all that knowledge I try to get rid of out of my head. It's no longer required. I've got my piece of paper. But when somebody asks me a question on that, I know the answer. It's just that you're just not thinking about it, you're not retaining it. So is there so much that our brain can, I suppose, hold, and information that we can hold, and just stuff that is sometimes irrelevant, we just push to the side?
Yeah, the brain is an amazing filtering system. Like, you know, it's not about forgetting, it's about retrieval, right? So what you mentioned there is essentially the key to memory, and it's called encoding, right? If we're reading something, it doesn't make any sense, right? Until we create an image for it. That's why reading in pictures is so powerful. In fact, that's how computers work and the internet and everything. You know, all those zeros and ones coming through the cables or wireless or whatever, and it's transported through, you know, protocols until a visual image gets spits out, you know, on the screen. So that's what happens in the brain as well. But you're not going to understand, like if someone gives you a name, it becomes so abstract, you don't know how to visualize it. So if you can visualize something first, then there's more of a chance of that being retained for a longer term. And if you can make a story out of that, and the story now is the connection, it's the glue. If you don't make a story, there's a chance it may still be in there. But if you do make a story, a connection, then that's how you remember. So I'll give you an example of that because people listening might go, well, what's this story business, right? So let's say you meet a Peter. Right? Someone's name's Peter. Now, on its own, Peter is quite abstract. There is no sort of meaning, right? I'm not talking about the meaning behind the name. It's just, you know, what the hell's Peter, right? But if you visualize, say, a Peter bread, right, on top of this guy's head, right, or his head looks like a Peter bread, now you've encoded that word into something meaningful, and you've created an image via a story with the Peter bread on his head, right? As soon as you do this and stay there for a while, in your brain, then what happens is next time this person's walking past them, why does that guy's head look like a Peter bread, Peter. So you get it like that. So what you said, you know, it used to be taught back then, it's not so much now, is that visualization of abstract data. As soon as you do that, it's easier to retain and remember.
It's, you know, the world heavyweight, two-time, when he made his comeback, world heavyweight boxing champion, George Foreman. I think he had seven sons. He named them all George. And he said, I've been punched in the head so many times, at least this way I won't forget any of their names. So it's, which I think is a sad indication on boxing to start with. But when it comes to retaining information as well, you know, you spoke, you know, what you said there, and I don't know how I do it or why I do it, but I teams have a tendency of when I've met someone, I can tell you, when I met you, where I met you that first time, and not necessarily the date and time, but where I actually met you, and I can actually memorize pretty much what you're wearing. I know Boyana just celebrated her 20-year work anniversary in here. I remember what she was wearing at her job interview when she first came. So I remember some of the, you know, the comments that were made and things like that. Same with Jamie, same with Jordan. Jordan had a navy blue suit his first day with us as well. And Chancellor, the first time I met you, you're wearing a jacket like you have on now, except it was darker. It was a darker grey. It was a darker form of grey, and it was in our boardroom with Maria, who had actually organised that. So how is it that I remember those things, or is that just something that I automatically do because I was, I won't say diagnosed, but it was more the fact of saying, okay, this is not necessarily my strength, but in being able to memorise other things over here. So in other words, rope learning was not necessarily a strength because reading was, say, difficult for me, but I could remember in pictures. So that's how I remember people's names or stories behind people.
Yeah, it's the visual capabilities. If you've been training that ever since you were young, my goodness, for years and years, that skill's developed to a really high level. And that's what I do essentially with people is that I train them up using various exercises, just like going to the gym. And people do these exercises and they just get better and better at visualization. Now, why visualization? It's because once you visualize, a story and an image is easier to connect into the brain as opposed to something that doesn't make sense, right? You look at the ancient Egyptians with hieroglyphics, they had images and stories on a wall. If we have text on a wall, it's going to take us forever to read, right? And to make text memorable, what do? We have fonts, right? Whereas images, it's so much easier to grasp and connect with. Now, on top of the visualization as well, and I think this is why you're so strong at it, is the emotional connection. As soon as you add emotion in there, then that drives that memory to another level as well. It's like, you know, if you're watching a horror movie and you get scared, right? The brain knows it's not real, but why does it get scared? It can't differentiate, doesn't know what's real and what's not. So if you drive emotion while you're, you know, remembering something, you know, then that's going to come to your mind more as well. I recently had a lady come to me saying, look, I can't remember anything. I went on a trip recently. I can't remember it. I'm like, okay, well, how did you get there? She said, oh, we drove. Did you go to any towns? Yeah, we went into this town. Would you eat anything? Oh, we had a couple of pies, blah, blah, blah. And because I asked more and more questions, all these, you know, images start coming back to her and she remembered her whole trip. So it's not, like I said, about forgetting. It's about how we retrieve this information. And if the information that we remember has connection to visuals and emotions, then we'll get it. If it doesn't, it's easier to forget.
Yeah, I've often said that having a head full of pictures and everything I remember in pictures, and I can see the visualization of what happened and what occurred at the time. But it's interesting because when I visualize certain things, as you said, you know, about the horror movie, but when I visualize something, say, in the past, it's I can get that feeling again. I can get that emotion I sort of felt at that time, that, you know, emotion of sadness when my father took his last breath, you know, or my emotion of happiness, you know, when my children were born. You know, I can actually, and as I say that to you, I'm visualizing that and I'm feeling that emotion actually well up again. But it's also interesting too, because which has really helped me in my life, but one of my favorite authors is an author by the name of Eckhart Tolle. And it's about, you know, the power of now, living in the now, not living in the past. And that has been wonderful for me because I've been able to let go of traumatic experiences or experiences that don't serve me well from my past. But what I find interesting is I've often said that my father was one of the greatest storytellers of all time. But when he spoke with emotion. He knew when to pause. He knew how to use his hands when he spoke or when the appropriate times are. The only thing he never realized that was, say, appropriate, because he loved to tell a joke, but he would start bursting into laughter halfway through telling the joke before we got to the punchline. So we're all sitting there saying, what's he laughing at? That aside, he is a magnificent storyteller. Eckhart Tolle, when I tried to listen to one of his books on an audio, which he was reading, and it was putting me to sleep. He's got one monotone all the way through. But I found storytellers and people who speak with passion tend to remember those stories even more, and they seem to be far more expressive when they're telling those stories as well. Is that speaking with memory telling those stories with expression, does that help you remember things even more?
Absolutely. You're not just talking about speaking from the brain, like communicating from what you know, but communicating from the heart. But that's another thing altogether. We talk about remembering from the heart and, off by heart, things like that. Emotions are more connected to the heart rather than the brain. So once you combine the brain and heart together, like telling of the words, but in an emotional state, it hits us in the heart. And therefore, that is not just memorable, but it's an experience now as well. Whereas, you said monotone, right? I think of death by PowerPoint. Why is that not memorable? You think about it. People are reading static dot by dot points. It's not making sense. They're in monotone. The opposite of that, they might have a couple of key points, but now they're telling a story from that. They're facing the audience, not directly looking at it. So you can sort of see how connection works. And memory is all about connection. It's understanding what's going to connect to people and what gets encoded in other people's minds as well and in their hearts. So if you know how to tell a really good story, you know what's going to work in terms of people receiving that information, because your words have an impact. And if you don't use that to the best of your abilities, then the people are going, what was being said here? I don't know what's going on. And when that goes on, what impact are you really having? You could have the best knowledge in the world, but if you don't know how to communicate it, it's kind of lost its point. So storytelling is such a huge art. And I think it's still, I don't think many people pay the respect it's due, even though there's a lot of people out there calling themselves storytellers and they do an amazing job. I don't think many people really know the power as well. So something like this podcast where we're talking about it, I think will hopefully get people tuning in saying, you know what, I'm going to try this in my next communication, or I'm going to apply these skills or techniques, or maybe I just get it now. Yeah,
it's interesting. You speak about the heart because, I've often been told, and actually one of our guests previously, who's a friend of ours as well, Mel Yu, we've been told, you wear your heart on your sleeve. We actually tell a story. We speak from the heart. What you're saying there is we were having a discussion last week or the week before about our ESG investment fund, which is, the environment and social and corporate governance and things like that. Now, a lot of our not-for-profits and charitable clients are in our ESG fund. And what we were discussing, if I said to you, yeah, our fund did really well in the last 12 months and earned 14.4%. Well, so what? But what impact did you have with your money? Well, by investing this way with an ESG focus, there was 4 tons of carbon per month reduced. Oh, sorry, that's wrong. Was some other measure. It was 4 tons of plastic removed from the oceans that didn't enter the oceans. It was 138,000 cigarettes, less cigarettes per day smoked as a result of these investments. There's 126 women employed for every 100 men. There's employed. There was 83% of parity of equality of income. So when you look at the UN 17 sustainability goals, so you can actually picture the amount of tuna that weren't harvested from the ocean, or the less plastic, or the cleaner environment from less carbon emissions. So rather than just talking about what the return of your money is and seeing that in a bank balance, actually understanding the impact of what you're actually doing is so vitally important too.
Yeah. And when people hear that, then they get it, because you want your staff, you want your people to get it. You want your stakeholders to get it. And if they get it, they understand you and the company more, and then they can talk about it and work towards the vision a little bit better and things like that. So, yeah, extremely powerful what you've, that example that you've given.
It sounds like both you and I do work quite a lot in the not-for-profit space as well, and you are, an ambassador for multiculturalism and a range of other things, something that this country has blessed us with, of having all that as well. But it's when you're working that sector, we understand that the work we're doing is about making positive change in the world. So whether it's making positive change by being able to tell an honest story in such a way that is captivating through memory, because we do remember these things. So actually, I'll ask you this question. I remember where I was, the car I was driving, what I was wearing. I know it was roughly 27 years ago because my oldest son, Josh, is 27. So he was about 2 months old. We were going, I know the restaurant we were going to, which is Giorgio's there on the corner of Malvern Road and Glenferry Road. And it was such a big impact when we heard that Princess Di had got killed in a car accident. And I also remember the World Trade Center. I remember exactly where I was when I saw it. I was just glued to the television. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And I remember the meeting that I had to have that day. It was with Jim Millage, who was the director of Bates Smart, a larger architectural firm. We're in their office at the Orica building, and we were overlooking, and you could see out of his boardroom window, and you saw 35 and 55 Collins Street, which is our very short version of the World Trade Center. So why is it such impactful things like that? We remember everything, where we were, the first time we heard it, what was actually said, and other things that just you see, you speak, you've forgotten about it 3 minutes later.
That's a good question. It's because it's a shock to the system. These things don't happen every single day, right? If we, you know, have lasagna for dinner, right? That's not really a shock. And that's why people always ask the question, what did you have for dinner last night? And, you know, most people can't remember it, or some people can, but it's just irrelevant. Whereas someone famous dying, or, you know, something critical happening in history of the world, yeah, it's going to not just be a shock, but it sends that emotional, visual, the storytelling component afterwards of what are the consequences now? What's going to happen? How's this changing the world? Like, all of this happens in your mind sometimes without even thinking about it. It's all in your subconscious. So a lot of that happens initially, and then the fallout afterwards where, you know, the news gets a hold of it, people start talking about it, so the narrative gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So all of that helps you remember and triggers back to that initial moment as well, when people always say, I knew when and where I was when such and such happened, because of everything that's happened afterwards, and all I have to do is trigger back for all of that as well. So it's a massive emotional trigger, essentially.
So I remember reading the book, I'm pretty sure the title is The Power of Habit, really good book, but I read it when my father had Alzheimer's. He was probably about a year before his passing. And what I found interesting in that book was, well, as per the title suggested, The Power of Habit, whereas it was before he went into aged care, and I was in the kitchen with him. I was looking after him because mum had gone out, and he would repeat the same thing every 4 minutes, make me a fresh cup of tea, even though I said, no, Dad, I'm fine, I don't want one. And then he would say, oh, you haven't got a cup of tea, and make me a fresh cup of tea. And you saw these things that he repeated doing himself. And you're standing in the kitchen, and I'd been reading the book, and so I thought I'd test one part of the book. And I said to Dad, Dad, where's the bathroom? Where's the toilet? And he just looked at me, and it wasn't a big house. It was a small house, my parents' house. And he just looked at me and he said, I don't know. But probably around about 15 minutes later, when he needed to go to the toilet, he just got up and walked straight to the toilet and went to the toilet and went and washed his hands. So asking the question, and we know Alzheimer's is a horrible disease, you know, that if you afflict someone, is, I often say, though, it's more horrible for the loved ones than what it is for the person, because they haven't necessarily remember that they've lost their memory. But from that perspective, I found that it was interesting, the power of habit, that when he needed to go to the bathroom, he didn't need to ask where the toilet was. He just got up and went straight there. But if you asked him where it was, he had no idea.
It's muscle memory. You know, it's just one of those things, whereas brain processing, that's completely different.
Can you explain that difference, Jim?
Well, when you're trying to process from the brain, the information's going in, and because of the inability, it's like, you know, it's loading. It's not working. Something's not going on right. So you're like, I don't know. But with muscle memory, it's almost like a habit. And a habit's something, it's automatic where you do it. So if someone says, get up and go to the kitchen, you're just going to do it without even, you know, knowing the directions there. So that's essentially what's happened. It's just pure habit. Now, I don't know how long you'd been living in that house, but if you've been doing that procedure for a long, long time.
Number of years.
Number of years. That's embedded in. So you sort of know, even without even knowing, if that makes sense.
Tansel, without necessarily asking you to be a psychologist or a psychiatrist here, there seems to be a generation. I blame smartphones, and not just social media, but smartphones in general. In saying that, when Jordan first came for a job interview with us, I saw he had an old Nokia, and I said to my partner, Jamie, I said, can you just see if he's okay with technology? Because I noticed he's got an old Nokia there, and he's fine. He's great with it. I call him for tech support. For our listeners, Jordan is on this call, and he's laughing right now because it's a true story. So and he ended up getting a smartphone. But it's but we seem to have a generation that get distracted very easily and don't necessarily have a great attention span. As I said, I don't know the answer, and I don't know if you know the answer, but do you have any thought process of why we have, say, Generation Z, which is realistically born from about 1994 to about 2012, and I would suggest it might even just get worse in the future, of people that have no attention span, are distracted very easily, and move on from quick things, get bored and move on to new things very quickly as well?
Yeah, I don't necessarily think it's smartphones, to be honest. I think the core of the issue is more in terms of people wanting stuff and getting it sooner rather than later.
Instantaneous gratification.
Exactly. So I think it's instant gratification, and things like smartphone make it easier to access, you know, like television. We had to wait a week until our favorite shows played. Now people can, you can just get on Netflix and binge a whole series. So it's like
instant. So I'm of the generation that, you know, if my dad wanted the channel changed, he had to call me into the room to walk up to TV because he wasn't going to get out the couch. There was no remote controls. So it's son, put on channel 7 for me. You know, you talk about that instantaneous gratification though, but is that provide, and once again, not asking for a medical answer here, but is this instantaneous gratification also causing a lot of unhappiness, not call it sadness and unhappiness, not depression, in this world? Because, you know, as an example, if I decide, well, I have decided that I want to drop 10 kilos and I went for a run this morning and I weighed myself tomorrow, I'll most likely be the same weight. So I don't have that instantaneous gratification of just because I felt like I want to be 10 kilos lighter. Interestingly enough, going back to one of the things we were talking about earlier, I do visualize myself at 10 kilos lighter, and that actually is what gives me the dopamine rush every morning to get up to do what I actually have to do. So from that, you know, okay, so not smartphones, et cetera, but is that instantaneous gratification causing a lot of sadness amongst young people in the world today?
I think it is, because again, they're wanting answers really quickly, and they're getting it, and that's giving them a dopamine hit.
Yeah.
Sorry, we just broke up then.
Oh, sorry, I was saying through Google.
Yeah, through Google. You know, it's where it sort of started, right? We're searching, we're getting answers. Now AI is giving us, you know, not just answers, but information and knowledge and, you know, all these other things. And you look at things like TikTok and, you know, social media, where it's just giving you whatever you search for, it's giving you the answers there in tenfold, with, you know, whatever influencer you want to follow or education piece you want to read about. So, but what's happening is that people are scrolling. I've read this. This is taking me 5 seconds. Next. So they're getting their dopamine hit. And what that means is, you know, the reward center's been activated in the brain, and they just want more of it. So it's like you're sort of addicted. Whereas if we know how to hold back on that, right, that delayed sort of gratification, then what that's going to do is teach, you know, that little bit of discipline that we need. And, you know, if you want to lose weight, that discipline is great, because you might say, look, I didn't lose anything, or I put on weight today, but I've got more opportunities, you know, throughout the week to do it. Whereas now it's like, you know, I've put on weight, no, I can't do it. So that people give up, because again, they haven't hit that reward center in their brain. So even if they don't lose anything, or even lose weight, but it's not what they think it should be, they'll stop. So that's the kind of issue there. And smartphones, yeah, that can contribute, but it's also the way that people think and, you know, how they control themselves. I think that's the main issue that I can personally see.
Yeah. Tansel, you do a lot of, I mean, you're a renowned speaker, main platform speaker, in respect to your memory training, and you also do a hell of a lot of memory training for executives, CEOs, and people in general. I'm assuming that, you know, you've helped over 20,000 people in respect to their memories, and you've coached, you know, one-on-one a lot of people as well. There was a documentary of Todd Sampson as a, you know, who, you know, and Todd does a lot of remarkable documentaries in respect to with you with the brain training, and then also, you know, with body challenges and things like that. He's got some great documentaries. How do you help individuals in respect to being able to learn things where they might have, to start with, put a label on themselves, I just can't remember names? And there's a great saying out of the movie Blindside, where it's not that you can't, it's just that you can't yet. You know, so it's so tell us some of the things that you do to help an executive move forward in respect to wanting to retain more information?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that question, because I get it a lot. I get it a lot. And I mean, I start off as a skeptic, and these people are at least coming to me knowing that they can, you know, improve. So, you know, they start off way better than what I did. But I do a little exercise. I said, okay, write down all the things that you're saying to yourself. So it could be, I can't do this, or I'm no good at this, or blah, 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 blah. I'm like, write it down. Acknowledge it, right? We don't want to give up on what you're saying. And then I say, okay, if you say I can't do this, then that's only one thing, like you just can't do it, right? However, if you ask yourself an open, positive question, how can you do it? You've got unlimited possibilities. How can you do it? Go read a book on it, you know, speak to someone about it that knows something, you know, talk to me, I'll give you some techniques, read a book, right? So you can list out so many things and say, you know, all those things that we listed out, go and do them, right? So they go and do, you know, A, B, C, D, E. They might stop at E and go, you know what? I get it now. So some people just need to know that there's opportunities out there, but not just that, to actually do them. It's not good enough just to say, oh, you can do it, because people don't know what they don't know, right? So, and even if they do know, they still don't know. So that's why I sort of work, I guess, as a guide, as an expert, to try and open their minds up so they can say, you know what, I've got all these possibilities. Yeah, I mean, I could show them, but it's even better if I show them how they can open their minds so they can go and, you know, have access to all the other things they can get answers to from. So, you know, that's, I think, just getting them to change their mindset and ask open questions, because if you ask questions, you get answers. If you ask good questions, you get good answers. Right, so that's where it essentially comes, and the more you do that, the more people start to change as well.
So you mentioned earlier, you know, regarding rope learning and things like that, and when it comes to school, learning in school, and school nowadays, you know, they talk to children a lot more about their emotions, whereas in my days it was just do as you're told. You know, so you're here to actually learn, and in my case, play sport. But otherwise, do as you're told. So in regards to moving forward, and, you know, just question without notice, and we'll make this the last question of today as well, because we will have many more conversations, and I will introduce you to many of our clients as well. What would you like to see in respect to school to be able to help children, this generation of children going through school at the moment, to be able to help them in respect to their learning, which then is in respect to their knowledge, and in respect to being able to help them become, you know, great people living in the world. So what are some of the things that you would like to see the school curriculum do nowadays moving forward to be able to help our current generation of school children?
Yeah, look, part of what I'm doing is from frustration, because I wasn't taught this at school. So I would say teach the techniques. They're not hard. Speed reading, they used to be taught in schools. Memory techniques, very, very easy. In 15 minutes, you can teach it, let alone how many classes, right? Mind mapping, all these skills you can teach, and then get students to practice those skills. So I think I told you about this. I created the world's first sort of school mind games. And I went to four different schools and I said, look, I'll come in and train, you know, a lot of your students. And instead of having an end of year exam, we'll have a school competition. Right? So what happened was these students spent a whole year practicing these skills. We only had three sessions, memory, mind mapping, and speed reading. That's it. And then they spent a whole year using these skills. By the end of the year, we had this competition, right? And these kids memorized my first book that I wrote, a 200-page book in 15 minutes. Then they wrote down everything they remembered on a big flip chart on the wall and mapped it all out, so planned it. And then they spoke out or presented that book, you know, almost chapter by chapter and what was underneath as well, perfectly. And then one of my students did a TED talk. We put his talk on the screen on a projector, and these students memorized his 11-minute TED talk word for word, you know, verbatim. And this was all in the space of just half a day. So if that could be done with just three lessons, imagine what could be done, you know, fitting this into a curriculum. I mean, it's insane. We had Channel 7 there. We had radio stations. People's jaws were on the floor. And these students, they weren't the greatest students either. So now we just leveled the playing fields with, you know, students that were low in their score to now competing against, you know, A graders. And in fact, I went back to those schools years later and saw some of the students were ducks of the school, you know, high 90s. And it was amazing to watch. But yeah, that's what I'd love to see. These skills go in, practice, and, you know, teachers knowing this stuff.
Where were you when I was a kid? With the exception of year 12, I did well in year 12, but I think for the first 11 years of my schooling life, it was about sport and socializing. And, you know, if I got 60% in an exam, it just meant I studied too hard. Which actually, when I got 60% in an exam, usually meant I never studied at all. I did well in year 12. The year I had to do, it was HSC back then, so the year I had to do well, I did well in. Tansel, I'm going to point out something that you just said then and reiterate it. I'm a very competitive person. It's just my nature. My father was a very competitive person as well. And it's interesting because if you came to me at school as a youngster and said, we're going to do this over three lessons, three half days, three lessons, and you're going to get this, and then we're going to do an exam at the end of that, I would have went into a panic. But if you said, and at the end of this, we're going to have a competition, I will come first. I will strive to come first. So isn't it interesting how you change the word from exam, which has a emotional reaction in me, which is not as positive as this will be a competition? Well, you'll see a very different side of Tony Kofkin that comes out of that just by rephrasing a word.
Yeah, well, I've done this in organizations as well, where I've gone in as an IT trainer, so I have an IT background, and I used to work at an ISP back in the day. It's called Netspace. And what they would do is they'd hire people, train them up for a couple of weeks, and if they were passing an exam at the end, they'll get the job, right? So what was happening was that they'd go through the 2 weeks induction or training, whatever it was, and just be absolutely miserable for the exam and just fail it. You know, multiple times they'll get opportunities for it. But if they fail multiple times, that's it. They don't get the job. So I went in there and saw that this was happening, and I changed the exam bit to, you know, quiz, and I created a little ladder on who can beat who. And this was all done online. Soon as I did that, the whole mindset, everything shifted. People stopped, you know, working on their computers to try and sit this exam that the trainees were in, to try and outdo them. And then trainees were outdoing the people working on the floor. So not just they were trying to pass, they were trying to outdo the other salespeople on the calls and the other IT tech people and whoever I was training. So it completely flipped the script and changed the mindset. And we used that model ever since. And then I thought, well, this has worked in previous life. Let me try it with the schools. And it sure did. Kids were competitive. I want to beat this school. You know, let's get together during lunch, before school, after school. I mean, if you sent for an exam, would students be doing that? No way. They'd cram last minute and off they go. But because it was a competition, different mindset.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Tansel, thank you so very much for today. We are going to put your contact details on our socials as well, so people can reach out to you. Really, really enjoyed this conversation. Really enjoying our friendship and looking forward to working with you for many decades to come.
Thanks, Craig. Looking forward to it too.
Craig, thanks. Well done, Tansel. Good, Ed.
That was my cat's name.
Mine was Pinky, so thank you. Thankfully, you didn't call me Pinky. Thank you so much, Tansel.
Okay.
Bye.
The Coffin Bond Podcast is a product from Coffin Bond & Co., which we are an authorised representative of Cairn Financial. All information in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. It is not intended as a substitute for professional finance, legal or tax advice. The hosts of the Coffin Bond Podcast are not aware of your personal financial circumstances. Before making any financial decision, you should read the product disclosure statement and, if necessary, consult a licensed financial professional. Do not take financial advice from the podcast. For more information, head to the disclaimer page on the Coffin Bond website, or you can find resources on the ASIC website and find a registered financial professional near you. In the spirit of reconciliation, Coffin Bond and Co. and the host of the Coffin Bond podcast acknowledge the traditional custodians of the country throughout Australia and their connections to land, sea and community. We pay our respects to their elders past, present and extend that respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people today.